Part 3. Long Runout. Anne Claiborne was driving down the Geneva Spur, stopping every few switchbacks to get out and take samples from the road cuts. The Trans-Marineris Highway had been abandoned after 61, as it now disappeared under the dirty river of ice and boulders covering the floor of Caprates Chasma. The road was an archaeological relic, a dead end. But Anne was studying the Geneva Spur. The spur was the final extension of a much longer lava dike, most of which was buried in the plateau to the south. The dike was one of several, the nearby Mellis Dorsa, the Felis Dorsa farther east, the Solis Dorsa farther west, all of them perpendicular to the Marineris Canyons and all mysterious in their origin. But as the southern wall of Mellis Chasma had receded by collapse and wind erosion, the hard rock of one dike had been exposed, and this was the Geneva Spur, which had provided the Swiss with a perfect ramp to get their road down the canyon wall, and was now providing Anne with a nicely exposed dike base. It was possible that it and all its companion dikes had been formed by concentric fissuring resulting from the rise of Tharsis, but they could also be much older remnants of a basin and range type spread in the earliest Noachian, when the planet was still expanding from its own internal heat. Dating the basalt at the foot of the dike would help answer the question one way or the other. So she drove a little boulder car slowly down the frost-covered road. The car's movement would be quite visible from space, but she didn't care. She had driven all over the southern hemisphere in the previous year, taking no precautions except when approaching one of Coyote's hidden refuges to resupply. Nothing had happened. She reached the bottom of the spur only a short distance from the river of ice and rock that now choked the canyon floor. She got out of the car and tapped away with a geologist's hammer at the bottom of the last road cut. She kept her back to the immense glacier and didn't think of it. She was focused on the basalt. The dike rose before her into the sun, a perfect ramp to the cliff top some 3 kilometers above her and 50 kilometers to the south. On both sides of the spur, the immense southern cliff of Mellis Chasma curved back in huge embayments, then out again to lesser prominences, a slight point on the distant horizon to the left, and a massive headland some 60 kilometers to the right, which Anne called Cape Solis. Long ago, Anne had predicted that greatly accelerated erosion would follow any hydration of the atmosphere, and on both sides of the spur, the cliff gave indications that she had been right. The embayment between the Geneva Spur and Cape Solis had always been a deep one, but now several fresh landslides showed that it was getting deeper fast. Even the freshest scars, however, as well as all the rest of the fluting and stratification of the cliff, were dusted with frost. The great wall had the coloration of Zion or Bryce after a snowfall, stacked reds streaked with white. There was a very low black ridge on the canyon floor, a kilometer or two west of the Geneva Spur, paralleling it. Curious, Anne hiked out to it. On closer inspection, the low ridge, no more than chest high, did indeed appear to be made of the same basalt as the spur. She took out her hammer and knocked off a sample. A motion caught her eye, and she jerked up to look. Cape Solis was missing its nose. A red cloud was billowing out from its foot. Landslide! Instantly, she started the timer on her wrist pad, then knocked the binocular hood down over her faceplate and fiddled with the focus until the distant headland stood clear in her field of vision. The new rock exposed by the break was blackish and looked nearly vertical. A cooling fault in the dike, perhaps, if it too was a dike. It did look like basalt, and it looked as if the break had extended the entire height of the cliff, all 4 kilometers of it. The cliff face disappeared in the rising cloud of dust, which billowed up and out as if a giant bomb had gone off. A distinct boom, almost subsonic, was followed by a faint roaring like distant thunder. She checked her wrist, a little under 4 minutes. Speed of sound on Mars was 252 meters per second, so the distance of 60 kilometers was confirmed. She had seen almost the very first moment of the fall. Deep in the embayment, a smaller piece of cliff gave way as well, no doubt triggered by shock waves, but it looked like the merest rockfall compared to the collapsed headland, which had to be millions of cubic meters of rock. Fantastic to actually see one of the big landslides. Most aerologists and geologists had to rely on explosions or computer simulations. A few weeks spent in Valles Marineris would solve that problem for them. And here it came, rolling over the ground by the edge of the glacier, a low, dark mass topped by a rolling cloud of dust, like time-lapse film of an approaching thunderhead, sound effects and all. It was really quite a long way out from the Cape. She realized with a start that she was witnessing a long, run-out landslide. They were a strange phenomenon, one of the unsolved puzzles of geology. The great majority of landslides move horizontally less than twice the distance they fall, but a few very large slides appear to defy the laws of friction, running horizontally 10 times their vertical drop, and sometimes even 20 or 30. These were called long run-out slides, and no one knew why they happened. Cape Solis now had fallen 4 kilometers, and so should have run out no more than 8. But there it was, well across the floor of Mellis, running down canyon directly at Anne. If it ran only 15 times its vertical drop, it would roll right over her and slam into the Geneva Spur. She adjusted the focus of her binoculars for the front edge of the slide, just visible as a dark, churning mass under the tumbling dust cloud. She could feel her hand trembling against her helmet, but other than that, she felt nothing. No fear, no regret. Nothing, in fact, but a sense of release. All over at last, and not her fault. No one could blame her for it. She had always said that the terraforming would kill her. She laughed briefly, and then squinted, trying to get a better focus on the front edge of the slide. The earliest standard hypothesis to explain long runouts had been that the rock was riding over a layer of air trapped under the fall. But then old long runouts discovered on Mars and Luna had cast doubts on that notion, and Anne agreed with those who argued that any air trapped under the rock would quickly diffuse upward. There had to be some form of lubricant, however, and other forms proposed had included a layer of molten rock caused by the slide's friction, acoustic waves caused by the slide's noise, or merely the extremely energetic bouncing of the particles caught on the slide's bottom. But none of these were very satisfactory suggestions, and no one knew for sure. She was being approached by a phenomenological mystery. Nothing about the mass approaching her under the dust cloud indicated one theory over another. Certainly it wasn't glowing like molten lava, and though it was loud, there was no way of judging whether it was loud enough to be riding on its own sonic boom. On it came in any case, no matter what the mechanism. It looked as though she was going to get a chance to investigate in person, her last act a contribution to geology, lost in the moment of discovery. She checked her wrist and was surprised to see that 20 minutes had passed already. Long runouts were known to be fast. The Blackhawk slide in the Mojave was estimated to have traveled at 120 kilometers per hour, going down a slope of only a couple of degrees. Mellis was in general a bit steeper than that. And indeed, the front edge of the slide was closing fast. The noise was getting louder, like rolling thunder directly overhead. The dust cloud reared up, blocking out the afternoon sun. Anne turned and looked out at the Great Marineris Glacier. She had almost been killed by it more than once, when it was an aquifer outbreak flooding down the Great Canyons, and Frank Chalmers had been killed by it, and was entombed somewhere in its ice far downstream. His death had been caused by her mistake, and the remorse had never left her. It had been a moment of inattention only, but a mistake nevertheless, and some mistakes you never can make good. And then Simon had died, too, engulfed in an avalanche of his own white blood cells. Now it was her turn. The relief was so acute it was painful. She faced the avalanche. The rock visible at the bottom was bouncing, it seemed, but not rolling over itself like a broken wave. Apparently it was indeed riding over some kind of lubricating layer. Geologists had found nearly intact meadows on top of landslides that had moved many kilometers, so this was confirmation of something known, but it certainly did look peculiar, even unreal. A low rampart advancing across the land without a rollover, like a magic trick. The ground under her feet was vibrating, and she found that her hands were clenched into fists. She thought of Simon fighting death in his last hours, and hissed. It seemed wrong to stand there welcoming the end so happily. She knew he would not approve. As a gesture to his spirit, she stepped off the low lava dike and went down onto one knee behind it. The coarse grain of its basalt was dull in the brown light. She felt the vibrations, looked up at the sky. She had done what she could. No one could fault her. Anyway, it was foolish to think that way. No one would ever know what she did here, not even Simon. He was gone. And the Simon inside her would never stop harassing her, no matter what she did. So it was time to rest and be thankful. The dust cloud rolled over the low dike. There was a wind. Boom! She was thrown flat by the impact of the noise, picked up and dragged over the canyon floor, thrown and pummeled by rock. She was in a dark cloud on her hands and knees, dust all around her, the roar of gnashing rock filling everything, the ground tossing underfoot like a wild thing. The jostling subsided. She was still on her hands and knees, feeling the cold rock through her gloves and knee pads. Gusts of wind slowly cleared the air. She was covered with dust and small fragments of stone. Shakily, she stood. Her palms and knees hurt, and one kneecap was numb with cold. Her left wrist felt the stab of a sprain. She walked up to the low dike, looked over it. The landslide had stopped about 30 meters short of the dike. The ground in between was littered with rubble, but the edge of the slide proper was a black wall of pulverized basalt, sloping back at about a 45-degree angle and 20 or 25 meters tall. If she had stayed standing on the low dike, the impact of the air would have thrown her down and killed her. "God damn you," she said to Simon. The northern border of the slide had run out onto the Mellis Glacier, melting the ice and mixing with it in a steaming trough of boulders and mud. The dust cloud made it hard to see much of that. Anne crossed the dike, walked up to the foot of the slide. The rocks at the bottom of it were still hot. They seemed no more fractured than the rock higher in the slide. Anne stared at the new black wall, her ears ringing. "Not fair," she thought. "Not fair." She walked back to the Geneva Spur, feeling sick and dazed. The boulder car was still on the dead-end road, dusty but apparently unharmed. For the longest time, she couldn't bear to touch it. She stared back over the long, smoking mass of the slide, a black glacier next to a white one. Finally, she opened the locked door and ducked inside. There was no other choice. Anne drove a little every day, then got out and walked over the planet doing her work doggedly like an automaton. To each side of the Tharsis Bulge there was a depression. On the west side was Amazonas Planitia, a low plain reaching deep into the southern highlands. On the east was the Crisi Trough, a depression that ran from the Argyre Basin through the Margaritifer Sinus and Crisi Planitia, the deepest point in the trough. The trough was an average of 2 kilometers lower than its surroundings, and all the chaotic terrain on Mars and most of the ancient outbreak channels were located in it. Anne drove east along the southern rim of Marinaris until she was between Nergal Vallis and the Aurium Chaos. She stopped to resupply at the refuge called Dolmen Tor, which was where Michelle and Casse had taken them at the end of their retreat down Marinaris in 2061. Seeing the little refuge again did not affect her. She scarcely remembered it. All her memories were going away, which she found comforting. She worked at it, in fact, concentrating on the moment with such intensity that even the moment itself went away, each instant a burst of light in a fog, like things breaking in her head. Certainly the trough predated the chaos and the outbreak channels, which were no doubt located there because of the trough. The Tharsis bulge had been a tremendous source of outgassing from the hot center of the planet, all the radial and concentric fractures around it leaking volatiles out of the hot center of the planet. Water in the regolith had run downhill into the depressions on each side of the bulge. It could be that the depressions were the direct result of the bulge, simply a matter of the lithosphere bent down on the outskirts of where it had been pushed up. Or it could be that the mantle had sunk underneath the depressions as it had plumed under the bulge. Standard convection models would support such an idea. The upwelling of the plume had to go back down somewhere, after all, rolling at its sides and pulling the lithosphere down after it. And then, up in the regolith, water had run downhill in its usual way, pooling in the troughs until the aquifers burst open and the surface over them collapsed. Thus, the outbreak channels and the chaos. It was a good working model, plausible and powerful, explaining a lot of features. So every day, Anne drove and then walked, seeking confirmation of the mantle convection explanation for the Crisi trough, wandering over the surface of the planet, checking old seismographs and picking away at rocks. It was hard now to make one's way north in the trough. The aquifer outbreaks of 2061 nearly blocked the way, leaving only a narrow slot between the eastern end of the Great Marineris Glacier and the western side of a smaller glacier that filled the whole length of Ares Vallis. This slot was the first chance east of Noctis Labyrinthus to cross the equator without going over ice, and Noctis was 6,000 kilometers away. So a piste and a road had been built in the slot, and a fairly large tent town established on the rim of Galilei Crater. South of Galilei, the narrowest part of the slot was only 40 kilometers wide, a zone of navigable plain located between the eastern arm of the Hydaspes Chaos and the western part of Aram Chaos. It was hard to drive through this zone and keep the piston road under the horizons, and Anne drove right on the edge of Aram Chaos, looking down onto the shattered terrain. North of Galilei it was easier, and then she was out of the slot and onto Crisi Planitia. This was the heart of the trough, with a gravitational potential of minus 0.65, the lightest place on the planet, lighter even than Hellas and Isidis. But one day she drove onto the top of a lone hill and saw that there was an ice sea out in the middle of Crisi. A long glacier had run down from Seamood Vallis and pooled in the Crisi low point, spreading until it became an ice sea, covering the land over the horizons to north, northeast, northwest. She drove slowly around its western shore, then its northern shore. It was some 200 kilometers across. Near the end of one day, she stopped her car on a ghost crater rim and stared out across the expanse of broken ice. There had been so many outbreaks in 61. It was clear that there had been some good aerologists working for the rebels in those days, finding aquifers and setting off explosions or reactor meltdowns precisely where the hydrostatic pressures were the greatest, using a lot of her own findings, it seemed. But that was the past. Banished now. All that was gone. Here and now there was only this ice sea. The old seismographs she had picked up all had records disturbed by recent temblors from the north, where there should have been very little activity. Perhaps the melting of the northern polar cap was causing the lithosphere there to rebound upward, setting off lots of small Mars quakes. But the temblors recorded by the seismographs were discrete short-period shocks, like explosions rather than Mars quakes. She had studied her car's AI screen through many a long evening, mystified. Every day she drove, then walked. She left the ice sea and continued north onto Acidalia. The great plains of the northern hemisphere were generally referred to as level, and they certainly were, compared to the chaoses or to the southern highlands, but still they were not level like a playing field or a tabletop, not even close. There were undulations everywhere, a continuous up-and-downing of hummocks and hollows, ridges of cracking bedrock, hollows of fine drifts, great rumpled boulder fields, isolated tors and little sinkholes. It was unearthly. On Earth, soil would have filled the hollows, and wind and water and plant life would have worn down the bare hilltops, and then the whole thing would have been submerged or subducted or worn flat by ice sheets, or uplifted by tectonic action. Everything torn away and rebuilt scores of times as the eons passed, and always flattened by weather and biota. But these ancient corrugated plains, their hollows banged out by meteor impact, hadn't changed for a billion years, and they were among the youngest surfaces on Mars. It was a hard thing to drive across such lumpy terrain, and very easy to get lost when out walking, particularly if one's car looked just like all the other boulders scattered about, particularly if one was distracted. More than once, Anne had to find the car by radio signal rather than visual sighting, and sometimes she walked right up to it before recognizing it, and then would wake up, or come to, hands shaking in the aftershock of some forgotten reverie. The best driving routes were along the low ridges and dikes of exposed bedrock. If these high basalt roads had connected one to the next, it would have been easy. But they commonly were broken by transverse faults, at first no more than line cracks, which then got deeper and wider as one progressed, in sequences like loaves of sliced bread tipping open, until the faults gaped and were filled with rubble and fines, and the dike became nothing but part of a boulder field again. She continued north onto Vastitas Borealis, Acidalia, Borealis. The old names were so strange. She was doing her best never to think, but during the long hours in the car it was sometimes impossible not to. At those times it was less dangerous to read than it was to try staying blank. So she would read randomly in her AI's library. Often she ended up staring at areological maps, and one evening at sunset after such a session, she looked into this matter of Mars's names. It turned out most of them came from Giovanni Schiaparelli. On his telescope maps, he had named over 100 albedo features, most of which were just as illusory as his canali. But when the astronomers of the 1950s had regularized a map of the albedo features everyone could agree on, features that could be photographed, many of Schiaparelli's names had been retained. It was a tribute to a certain power he had had, a power evocative, if not consistent. He had been a classical scholar and a student of biblical astronomy, and among his names there were Latin, Greek, Biblical, and Homeric references all mixed together. But he had had a good ear, somehow. One proof of his talent was the contrast between his maps and the competing Martian maps of the 19th century. A map by an Englishman named Proctor, for instance, had relied on the sketches of a Reverend William Dawes. And so on Proctor's Mars, which had no recognizable relations even to the standard albedo features, there was a Dawes continent, a Dawes ocean, a Dawes strait, a Dawes sea, and a Dawes forked bay. Also an airy sea, a Delarue ocean, and a Beer sea. Admittedly, this last was a tribute to a German named Beer who had drawn a Mars map even worse than Proctor's. Still, compared to them, Schiaparelli had been a genius, but not consistent. And there was something wrong in this melange of references, something dangerous. Mercury's features were all named after great artists. Venus's were named after famous women. They would drive or fly over those landscapes one day and feel that they lived in coherent worlds. Only on Mars did they walk about in a horrendous mishmash of the dreams of the past, causing who knew what disastrous misapprehensions of the real terrain. The Lake of the Sun, the Plain of Gold, the Red Sea, Peacock Mountain, the Lake of the Phoenix, Cimmeria, Arcadia, the Gulf of Pearls, the Gordian Knot, Styx, Hades, Utopia. On the dark dunes of Vastitas Borealis, she began to run low on her supplies. Her seismographs showed daily temblors to the east, and she drove toward them. On her walks outside, she studied the garnet sand dunes and their layering, which revealed the old climates like tree rings. But snow and high winds were tearing off the crests of the dunes. The westerlies could be extremely strong, enough to pick up sheets of large-grained sand and hurl them against her car. The sand would always settle in dune formations as a simple matter of physics, but the dunes would be picking up the pace of their slow march around the world, and the record they had made of earlier ages would be destroyed. She forced that thought from her mind and studied the phenomenon as if there were no new artificial forces disturbing it. She focused on her work as if clenching her geologist's hammer, as if breaking apart rocks. The past was spalled away, piece by piece. Leave it behind. She refused to think of it. But more than once she jerked out of sleep with the image of the long run-out coming at her, and then she was awake for good, sweating and trembling, faced with the incandescent dawn, the sun blazing like a chunk of burning sulfur. Coyote had given her a map of his caches in the north, and now she came to one buried in a cluster of house-sized boulders. She restocked, leaving a brief thank-you note. The last itinerary Coyote had given her said he was going to be dropping by this area sometime soon, but there was no sign of him and no use waiting. She drove on. She drove, she walked, but she couldn't help it. The memory of the landslide haunted her. What bothered her was not that she had had a brush with death, which no doubt had happened many times before, mostly in ways she hadn't noticed. It was simply how arbitrary it had been. It had nothing to do with value or fitness. It was pure contingency. Punctuated equilibrium without the equilibrium. Effects did not follow from causes, and one did not get one's just deserts. She was the one who had spent too much time outdoors, after all, taking on far too much radiation. But it was Simon who had died. And she was the one who had fallen asleep at the wheel, but it was Frank who had died. It was simply a matter of chance, of accidental survival or erasure. It was hard to believe natural selection had made any way in such a universe. There, under her feet, in the troughs between the dunes, archaebacteria were growing on sand grains. But the atmosphere was gaining oxygen fast, and all the archaebacteria would die out except those that were by accident underground, away from the oxygen they themselves had respired, the oxygen that was poisonous to them. Natural selection or accident? You stood, breathing gases, while death rushed toward you, and were covered by boulders and died, or covered by dust and lived. And nothing you did mattered in that great either-or. Nothing you did mattered. One afternoon, reading randomly in the AI to distract herself between her return to the car and her dinner hour, she learned that the Tsarist police had taken Dostoevsky out to be executed and only brought him back in after several hours of waiting for his turn. Anne finished reading about this incident and sat in the driver's seat of her car, feet on the dash, staring at the screen blindly. Another garish sunset poured through the window over her, the sun weirdly large and bright in the thickening atmosphere. Dostoevsky had been changed for life, the writer declared in the easy omniscience of biography. An epileptic, prone to violence, prone to despair. He hadn't been able to integrate the experience. Perpetually angry, fearful, possessed. Anne shook her head and laughed, angry at the idiot writer who simply didn't understand. Of course you didn't integrate the experience. It was meaninglessness, the experience that couldn't be integrated. The next day, a tower poked over the horizon. She stopped the car, stared at it through the car's telescope. There was a lot of ground mist behind it. The temblors registering on her seismograph were very strong now and appeared to be coming from a bit to the north. She even felt one of them herself, which, given the car's shock absorbers, meant they were strong indeed. It seemed likely there was a connection with the tower. She got out of her car. It was almost sunset, the sky a great arch of violent colors, the sun low in the hazy west. The light would be behind her, making her very hard to see. She wound between dunes, then carefully made her way to the crest of one and crawled the final meters of the way and looked over the crest at the tower, now only a kilometer to the east. When she saw how close its base was, she kept her chin right on the ground among ejecta the size of her helmet. It was some kind of mobile drilling operation. A big one. The massive base was flanked by giant caterpillar tracks, like those used to move the largest rockets around a spaceport. The drill tower rose out of this behemoth more than 60 meters, and the base and lower part of the tower clearly contained the technicians' housing and equipment and supplies. Beyond this thing, a short distance down a gentle slope to the north, was a sea of ice. Immediately north of the drill, the crests of the great Barkan dunes still stuck out of the ice, first as a bumpy beach, then as hundreds of crescent islands. But a couple of kilometers out, the dune crests disappeared, and it was ice only. The ice was pure, clean, translucent purple under the sunset sky, clearer than any ice she had ever seen on the Martian surface, and smooth, not broken like all the glaciers. It was steaming faintly, the frost steam whipping east on the wind, and out on it, looking like ants, people in walkers and helmets were ice skating. It came clear the moment she saw the ice. Long ago, she herself had confirmed the big impact hypothesis, which accounted for the dichotomy between the hemispheres. The low, smooth northern hemisphere was simply a super-huge impact basin, the result of a scarcely imaginable collision in the Noachian between Mars and a planetesimal nearly as big as it. The rock of the impact body that had not vaporized had become part of Mars itself, and there were arguments in the literature that the irregular movements in the mantle that had caused the Tharsis bulge were late developments resulting from perturbations originating with the impact. To Anne, that wasn't likely. But what was clear was that the great crash had happened, wiping out the surface of the entire northern hemisphere and lowering it by an average of 4 kilometers relative to the south. An astonishing hit, but that was the Noachian. An impact of similar magnitude had in all probability caused the birth of Luna out of Earth. In fact, there were some anti-impact holdouts arguing that if Mars had been hit as hard, it should have had a moon as big. But now, as she lay flat looking at the giant drilling rig, the point was that the northern hemisphere was even lower than it first appeared, for its floor of bedrock was amazingly deep, as much as 5 kilometers beneath the surface of the dunes. The impact had blown that deep, and then the depression had mostly refilled, with a mixture of ejecta from the big impact, wind-blown sand and fines, later impact material, erosional material sliding down the slope of the great escarpment, and water. Yes, water. Finding the lowest point as it always did. The water in the annual frost hood, and the ancient aquifer outbreaks, and the outgassing from the blistered bedrock, and the lensing from the polar cap, had all eventually migrated to this deep zone and combined to form a truly enormous underground reservoir, an ice and liquid pool that extended in a band all the way around the planet, underlying almost everything north of 60 degrees north latitude, except, ironically, for a bedrock island on which the polar cap itself stood. Anne herself had discovered this underground sea many years before, and by her estimates, between 60% and 70% of all the water on Mars was down there. It was, in fact, the Oceanus Borealis that some terraformers talked about, but buried, deeply buried, and mostly frozen and mixed with regolith and dense vines, a permafrost ocean with some liquid down on the deepest bedrock. All locked down there for good, or so she had thought, because no matter how much heat the terraformers applied to the planet's surface, the permafrost ocean wouldn't thaw much faster than a meter per millennium, and even when it did melt, it would remain underground simply as a matter of gravity. Thus the drilling rig before her. They were mining the water. Mining the liquid aquifers directly, and also melting the permafrost with explosives, probably nuclear explosives, and then collecting the melt and pumping it onto the surface. The weight of the overlying regolith would help push the water up through pipes. The weight of water on the surface would help push up more. If there were very many drilling rigs like this one, they could put a tremendous amount on the surface. Eventually, they would have a shallow sea. It would refreeze and become an ice sea again for a while, but between atmospheric warming, sunlight, bacterial action, increasing winds, it would melt again, eventually. And then there would be an Oceanus Borealis, and the old Vastatas Borealis, with its world-wrapping black garnet dunes, would be sea bottom, drowned. She walked back to her car in the twilight, moving clumsily. It was difficult to operate the locks, to get her helmet off. Inside, she sat before the microwave without moving for more than an hour, images flitting through her mind. Ants burning under a magnifying glass, an anthill drowned behind a mud dam. She had thought that nothing could reach her anymore in this pre-posthumous existence she was living, but her hands trembled, and she couldn't face the rice and salmon cooling in the microwave. Red Mars was gone. Her stomach was a small stone in her body. In the random flux of universal contingency, nothing mattered. And yet... She drove away. She couldn't think of anything else to do. She returned south, driving up the low slopes, past Chrysi and its little ice sea. It would be a bay of the larger ocean, eventually. She focused on her work, or tried. She fought to see nothing but rock, to think like a stone. One day she drove over a plain of small black boulders. The plain was smoother than usual, the horizon its usual 5 kilometers away, familiar from Underhill and all the rest of the lowlands. A little world, and completely filled with small black boulders, like fossil balls from various sports, only all black and all faceted to one extent or another. They were ventifacts. She got out of the car to walk around and look. The rocks drew her on. She walked a long way west. A front of low clouds rolled over the horizon, and she could feel the wind pushing at her in gusts. In the premature dark of the suddenly stormy afternoon, the boulder field took on a weird beauty. She stood in a slab of dim air, rushing between two planes of lumpy blackness. The boulders were basalt rocks, which had been scoured by the winds on one exposed surface until that surface had been scraped flat. Perhaps 1 million years for that first scraping. And then the underlying clays had been blown away, or a rare Mars quake had shaken the region, and the rock had shifted to a new position, exposing a different surface, and the process had begun again. A new facet would be slowly scraped flat by the ceaseless brushing of micron-sized abrasives until once again the rock's equilibrium changed, or another rock bumped it, or something else shifted it from its position. And then it would start again. Every boulder in that field shifting every 1 million years or so, and then lying still under the wind for day after day, year after year. So that there were ein contours with single facets, and dry contours with three facets, vier contours, fünf contours, all the way up to nearly perfect hexahedrons, octahedrons, dodecahedrons, ventifacts. Anne hefted one after another of them, thinking about how many years their plain sides represented, wondering whether her mind might not reveal similar scourings, big sections worn flat by time. It began to snow. First swirling flakes, then big soft blobs pouring down on the wind. It was relatively warm out, and the snow was slushy, then sleety, then an ugly mix of hail and wet snow, all flailing down in a hard wind. As the storm progressed, the snow became very dirty. Apparently it had been pushed up and down in the atmosphere for a long time, collecting fines and dust and smoke particulates, and crystallizing more moisture, and then flying up on another updraft in the Thunderhead to do it again, until what came down was nearly black. Black snow. And then it was a kind of frozen mud that was falling, filling in the holes and gaps between the ventifacts, coating their tops, then dropping off their sides as the keening wind caused a million little avalanches. Anne staggered aimlessly, pointlessly, until she twisted an ankle and stopped, her breath racking in and out of her, a rock clutched in each cold, gloved hand. She understood that the long run-out was running still. And mud snow pelted down out of the black air, burying the plane.
This ends side 2 of cassette 4 of Green Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 5.